Welcome to the Sad Girls Club Literary Podcast. Today, we are going to hear Acre of Moon, read by the author Lou Story. This creative nonfiction piece was published on our blog on August 29th, 2020. To read this story and many others, visit us on the web at sadgirlsclublit.com. Before we get into this story, here's a word from our sponsor.
Parental guidance was redefined in our household. Family was just me, my sister Lynn, and our father Punch. Yes, Punch, like the puppet whose face was all nose. Our mother had died when Lynn was five and I was practically brand new. Punch never intended to raise kids, and he made that clear from the get-go. We were shuffled around to various relatives, friends, neighbors, and foster care, not to be his until we were both old enough to hold somewhat of a conversation. Punch was the oldest of four brothers, all born to Anna and Louie. Anna was a backwater Pennsylvania farm girl, married late at the age of 25. Lumpy, crow-faced, and lacking any elegance or refinement, she accepted the proposal from Louie, an Italian-American near stranger. It was a kind of providence that fueled her unwavering devotion to him, despite her family's rejection of her marriage to a dark-skinned Italian, and despite her husband's eventual infidelities and habitual cruelties. Anna was used to cruelty. Her mother had been a beauty in her day and disdained her daughter's lumpish countenance. "Mama, am I pretty?" Anna would ask. "I suppose you could pass on a galloping horse," was her mother's stock reply. A legacy of cruelty runs through our family. Punch was a target for his father's ongoing wrath. Every communication between them had a subtext of disappointment. "A son must hate his father," Punch would tell me. Had I been more astute, I'd have benefited from his advice. I was not the son Punch wanted. Is there such a thing as a manly boy? Perhaps had I been a Hardy boy or a Spinnin' Marty boy, it all would have been okay. But I was not. And although a boy, I was, at best, boyish, a boy by default, barely a boy. Could Punch have sensed my queerness years before even I was aware of it? Did he hope to build in me a sturdy dam of shame to hold back, choke off my true nature? Whatever it was, Punch's disapproval came often, delivered in simple declarative adjectives. "Fussy," he would bark, his face grimacing as if he'd had a whiff of something foul. "Delicate," pursing his lips in a disdainful gesture. I'd accumulated a whole list of these words, an ever-growing inventory: sissy, baby, retard, orphan, wimp, sad sack, little pussy, the last of which seemed confusingly more of an endearment. Who doesn't like kittens? Like a letter marked return to sender, Lynn and I eventually aged enough to live with Punch. "Don't ask me for things. You got a self-parent, got that? It means before you do something, you ask yourself, what would a mommy or a daddy want me to do? Then you do that. Self-parent, got it?" If Punch was going to teach us anything, it was how to raise ourselves. It seemed so simple, but we kept messing up all the time. "Wouldn't a mommy or daddy want me to have anything I desired, like that Reese's peanut butter cup in that shiny package? There are so many of them, and several fit nicely into my pocket." When we did get into trouble, Punch was inconsolable. "What's wrong with you?" he'd lament. "Why do you keep getting caught?" Punch could care less what we did, as long as it did not interrupt his freewheeling bachelor's existence in any way. He mostly stayed busy with projects that kept him elsewhere. One exception was his big hole project, a mysterious excavation. Midweek, in early summer of 1969, he began hurriedly digging a hole in the backyard. Every day, he'd continue his strenuous efforts, making the hole bigger and bigger. "Are you making a garden?" I asked. "With silver bells and cockle shells and pretty maids all in a row. Ding dong, ding dong," he sang in reply, tilting his whiskered head back and forth like a ringing bell. After that, I made it a point to stay safely inside the house, avoiding the backyard. Day after day, I would look out the window, seeing Punch slowly disappearing from view as the pit deepened. It reminded me of pictures I had seen of World War I trenches, sans the barbed wire. As each day passed, mounds of dirt and stone surrounding his project rose higher. The hole looked like the foundation for an in-ground swimming pool that lacked a shallow end. In the moonless dark of night, there were voices and commotion in the driveway. I snuck down from my attic lair for a better look. As best I could make out, several cars, headlights out, processioning up the driveway, crossing into my backyard. Knowing from an early age that stupidity can disguise itself as bravery, I crept back up to the safety of my room. In the morning, the dirt mounds were gone, the pit filled. In its place were rows of newly planted grapevines. My secret garden, Punch called it. Like Pippi Longstocking, I could mostly do as I pleased. The one exception was during what Punch called his Wednesday night special. As directed, every week I would disappear for 2 hours so that Punch could have his special lady, a prostitute, make a house call. It made me think of the commercial, "Ding dong, Avon's calling," but that was a different kind of lady. Initially, having to vacate felt like an affront, but I soon discovered that my peers would pay good money to see what an honest-to-God prostitute looked like. I often wondered if she observed us, legs dangling down from our perch in the large oak next to the house. If so, she played dumb, but always seemed to need to delay every few steps between her car and the house, fixing her hair, bending down to check her stockings, adjusting her bosoms. My charges got their dollars worth. Under these circumstances, my sister and I honed exceptional grifter skills, perfecting a stance of amoral innocence. One upping each other was another family tradition. I'd made the mistake at age 10 of bragging to Lynn about my accumulated wealth, totaling $15. "It's hidden, well hidden," I replied to her innocent question of where my loot was stored. Search though she might, she would never find it, eager as she was to locate and plunder. She could tear apart my little corner of the attic all she liked. It was not there. My fortune was in a place she would never think to look, safely stowed beneath the rug under her bed. The following day, one of Lynn's friends, Sue, was visiting. Pulling Lynn conspicuously aside, she was excitedly telling her all about her father's new real estate venture, selling plots on the moon. "The moon," I said incredulously. Sue ignored me. "Lynn, your little brother is eavesdropping, and this is top secret information." "I won't tell anyone," I promised. Sue softened and said what an incredible deal it was for those in the know. "What's the cheapest?" I asked. "On the sun side, way too expensive, but he still has some plots left on the dark side. At $15 an acre, a real steal." Well, of course, it was a steal in only one way, but I was hooked. My own piece of the moon. I did not mind being on the dark side. The attic was dark, and it suited me just fine. I forked over my 15, learning a few new swear words as Lynn discovered my secret hiding place. In a businesslike manner, Sue advised me to wait a few months and expect a package in the mail with the land deed and all of the particulars. I waited and waited. Lynn launched as required at 18, and it was understood that I would do the same. Now it was just me and Punch, and Wednesday's special lady. More and more it was clear to me that my grown-up Wednesday nights would not be filled with a special lady. An R rating for the movie Boys in the Band meant that I would not be admitted. It was 1970, and I was just a year shy of eligible. My usual method for getting around the Motion Picture Association rules was to scrutinize the movie line and zero in on someone with a weak chin who might have trouble saying no. But with this movie, that seemed kind of risky. I was curious, but not that curious. My only way in was to be accompanied by a parent or adult guardian. To pass my music test, I need you to take me to see a musical called The Boys in the Band, was my fabricated lure for punch, adding the clincher, my treat, sold. My generous treat was all his money, transferred stealthily from his wallet into my pocket on an ongoing basis. He was an easy mark most of the time, and when he did start questioning his thinning wallet, I would shrug and point to all the Chianti bottles, dead soldiers overflowing the trash can that usually quieted him down. I was taking a risk, asking Punch to accompany me. I really want to see this movie. It has men kissing. That would go over big with Macho Punch, whose name was Jermaine both as a noun and a verb. It could all go south quickly, but like my beleaguered grandmother would say, I'll jump off that bridge when I get to it. Standing in line for the movie, I had been smart to make Punch my date. All good-looking older men, many of whom I imagined would happily have accompanied me into the movie and maybe later for dinner or walk in the park. Beyond that, my imagination shut down. I was not ready. But perhaps this movie would fill in the blanks. Homosexuality in 1970 was officially a paraphilic disorder. I had looked it up at the school library. Urges and arousals of a sexual nature that are disturbing, that involve suffering and humiliation. Sexual acts can include animals, children, and inanimate objects. The school librarian hovered nearby, likely made suspicious by a student in her realm appearing at all interested or engaged. "Can I help you, young man?" she asked in a tone that suggested I was doing something wrong. "Yes," I said. "Would my hand be considered an inanimate object?" "Only if you were dead," she sniffed, which put me much at ease. Punch and I walked the length of the movie theater's aisle to sit right up front. I did not want to miss a thing and didn't want Punch to scope out the audience and put two and two together. He would sooner or later, but at this point, if he stormed out, who cares? I needed him to get in, not to get out. We sat in the darkened theater and watched the movie, high camp drama from the start. As promised, a lot of suffering and humiliation, but no children, animals, or dead things, just a bunch of men that Punch would likely have called crybabies or worse. This is it. Where's the kissing, the nudity? This is 1970, not 1950. I could not figure out what all the fuss was about. Growing bored with the movie's emotional machinations, I began to hope for Punch to cause a scene, just to liven things up. I stole a few glances toward him, especially during the movie's blindingly gay moments. He sat, quietly, unfazed. At one point, I even wondered if my father had perfected a way of sleeping with his eyes open. You know, with Punch, you never could be sure of anything. At last, right toward the end of the movie, when the boys are all weeping, hugging, flooded with a combination of self-loathing and hope, Punch turned to me and gave me a nudge. "Hey, if this is a musical, where's all the music?" he asked. To this day, I marvel at the mystery of exactly how Punch saw the world. Banking on my good fortune and his curious obliviousness, I joined him in confusion. "I know, some musical," I said with great indignation. "You got gypped, buddy boy," Punch chuckled. "Totally duped," he added with satisfaction. One of the many unintended benefits of having an unfit parent was my work ethic, born of necessity. If I wanted something, I'd have to figure out how to get it, and if I wanted to keep it, I better also hide it well. Beyond my household duties, property care, cooking, cleaning, laundry, and food purchasing, I was also expected to work. This felt more like a privilege than an imposition. I felt sorry for my friends whose parents had big expectations of them. They would police their homework, monitor their grades, force them into activities they did not want to do to ensure they were well-rounded, all of which seemed to make them miserable. They were powerless, and they envied my freedom. I liked running the house, and I liked working. I worked at first informally, not being old enough for a work permit. I swept up hair at a barber shop, crackling with dirty jokes and lewd comments. Had I been savvy, I would have learned a lot, but it was all gibberish, and I left there as innocent as I'd entered. That led to tagging, washing, hanging, and bagging clothes in a dry cleaning establishment's back room. The owner turned off the exhaust system to cut costs. In response to my heaving and coughing, he promised, "You'll get used to it." I quit after a month for the luxury of a fresh air paper route and a job at a pizzeria cleaning and hauling crust-filled garbage. Summers, the work was full-time. During the school year, it was whenever possible. How I got through high school without even actually doing homework is a wonder. However, the expectation for those of us relegated to the bottom of the academic heap was slim. Just show up and keep quiet. My big break came when I turned 14, got my papers, and landed a job at ShopRite Supermarket, a legitimate job with a real time clock, just like in the movies, with the thunderous clunk of punching a time card in and out. We would line up every 2 weeks as the franchise owner showed up to hand over the pay. I was told his name, but could only remember him as Mr. ShopRite. He was amicable enough, although he worked at looking tough. A big man, graying hair and ample belly, always dark-suited, end of the day disheveled, he would hand out cash with a furrowed brow and a menacing scowl. One payday, a month into my employment, Punch showed up and stormed his way to the counter. "He's holding out on me," Punch snarled at Mr. ShopRite. I wasn't. Why hold out on something I could retrieve later? Now convinced that he was getting the full amount, Punch left, pocketing my pay. Mr. ShopRite called me over. Feeling guilty and embarrassed, I started to apologize. "Here, this is for you." Seeing my lack of comprehension, he smacked his palm hard against his forehead, repeating, "This is for you," dummy implied. "Not him. Hide it." I received double pay from then on. I worked at ShopRite through high school, climbing proudly up the supermarket ladder from outdoor cart collector to indoor bagger and eventually the pinnacle of my ShopRite career, cashier. Being left-handed guarantees a life of out of step, yet felt curiously aligned to my burgeoning gayness. The cash register was to my right, while I used my left hand to move the goods along the belted ramp. Each price had to be hand-keyed into the register in the days before the easily scanned multi-stripe barcode. Having to use my uncoordinated right hand to strike the various keys made me the turtle instead of the rabbit in the cashiering race. "I don't have all day," someone might say, or, "This must be your first day, right?" Management warned me. Not everyone is cut out to be a cashier. Speed it up, or so long, cashier, hello, bagger. Rather than suffer the humiliation of being demoted, I realized that if I hit the wrong numbers, people only complained of a higher price. Holding my right hand toward the bottom of the register, where the lower number keys were, I could blindly strike the keys, turning, say, 98 cents into 34 cents. No one seemed to mind those errors. I slapped away at the register like a pro. My speed was impressive. Soon, long lines of people were waiting to have me as their cashier. Other checkout counters would be empty, their cashiers at their stations waving their arms, calling out, signaling their availability. My loyal customers looked down at their shoes, pretending not to notice. My long lines were becoming suspicious. Management questioned me about it, but I was ready for them. So embarrassing, I confessed. I tell all my friends, family, and neighbors to come here to ShopRite for high-quality goods at affordable prices. I guess maybe they just really like me. An insidious lie that management ate up. I was awarded Employee of the Month with my name chalked on the employee bulletin board in pastel colors. Toward the end of my senior year, things had gotten progressively more difficult with Punch. On her own, Lynn was running up debt and enjoying what she called her party college circuit, moving from Florida to Kentucky to whatever school was the right combination of fun and cheap. The prospect of college and the subsequent costs loomed ahead for me as well. The promise that I would be 18 and gone was still months away, so I did not see it coming. Dragged from my bed, his liquor-soaked breath fuming, Punch was on the warpath. Having tripped over the vacuum cleaner that I'd left out in the living room, Punch intended to repair his bruised ego. Flung down the attic steps, I recovered my wits just long enough to make a heart-pounding dash to the second-floor steps. Then he was on me, spinning me around, face to face. To secure myself from falling backward down the flight of stairs, I grabbed hold of the banisters on my left and right, arms outstretched, leaving myself wide open for blow after blow to my pigeon chest. I saw two choices with crystal clarity, as if stills in a movie: release my grip and fall headfirst toward the window on the landing below. My skull would crack the window ledge hard, next to a hospital bed, then a wheelchair, disabled, an outcome that would seal both Punch's fate and my own. This vision had a dark satisfaction, an ultimate victory as seen through a lifelong victim's eyes. The other choice was more straightforward. Let go of one hand and swing to my left, making Punch lose his balance while I ran for the back door. Escaping across the lawn toward the street, he called after me, "Come back here, you little faggot, and I'll kill you, just like I killed your mother." Reaching the road, I heard him in the distance, and I'll get away with it again, too. Wait and see. I wasn't going to wait and see. I would never live there again. I slept for a few hours in a neighbor's lawn chair until morning. Three rules presented themselves instantly regarding scouting out neighborhood yards for sleeping. No dogs, even the sweet ones bark at you. No outdoor lighting, the point's to be invisible, not center stage. Good quality outdoor furniture. Wicker left a grid branding across my cheek. Scoring an upholstered chaise lounge was a jackpot. I woke up damp every morning. Leaving town was an option. Not finish school, but that choice would be Punch's victory, ensuring for me a lifetime of low-wage jobs. No, with just over 2 months left, I'd finish school. The weather was warm, and I could come up with sleeping arrangements. I would no longer be splitting my wages with Punch, and I worked at a food store. I'd been on my own all along anyway, just in a different way. Being untethered and intent on survival gave me strength and did something new. A desire for revenge.
We hope you enjoyed Acre of Moon by Lou Story. We are always looking for submissions for our blog and podcast. To submit your work for publication, visit sadgirlsclublit.com and click on submissions at the top of the home screen. Thanks for listening.